My name is Victoria Matei.
My name is Olga Araceli.
And we are both undocumented women of color.
How does one come to be undocumented, a refugee, a migrant?
So before we can kind of have an idea on how to answer some of these things, we, you know, have to look at the root of the problem. And so that brings us to today's topic of border imperialism. And we're, you know, the main thing that we've used for this podcast is a book titled Undoing Border Imperialism by Harsha Walia. But before that, we should probably check in. And I think we can begin by apologizing for not posting in a couple weeks.
Yeah, definitely.
We just ran into our first like hiccup of what this podcast world is like and lost one of our recordings that was really awesome. But we're gonna just, you know, work through it. It happens. And I think that was just a learning curve for all of us. Mm-hmm. But here we are now, and hopefully you enjoy this episode. So Olga, we went to a concert together.
Yes. I tried to remember the date. I think it was November 2nd.
Yeah.
November 2nd. And we went to go see Los Angeles Azules. And it was really fun. Like, we had forgotten about the whole thing, I feel, for a while. And then the week of, we were like, oh yeah, we have to go. Or like, we're going. So it was really fun. We took our moms and my sister. And we all just, like, had really fun, like, a really fun time just enjoying the music and watching them play. And I was really fangirling
over... Oh, she was. Oh, my goodness.
Over one of the lead singers. Like, I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was his voice, the way, like, his dancing. I don't know.
He was pretty cute, but... She was all about it.
Yeah, I have like tons of recording and pictures.
Oh my gosh. Oh, you would.
I did. Oh my gosh. I just loved it. I was really excited to kind of like enjoy and spend like that time with our moms, because I feel like we don't get to do that a lot. I feel like they grew up listening to, you know, like Los Angeles.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And so it was really cool, like seeing them like
get down to it. And then like my mom was super surprised that like I knew like the lyrics, everything. She was like, "What?"
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was great.
It was a good time. Other than that, I've just been like working and trying to keep up with life. So nothing too exciting.
Yeah, for me, I like right before I went to Seattle for the concert, I went to Portland for Halloween and got to see some old friends, old roommates, and just had a really good time, but spent way too much money on food. If you know me, like, I cannot resist fried food. I don't care what it is. If it's fried tofu, fried cauliflower, fried cheese, give it to me. I want it. It's like my weakness. So ate a lot of fried food. It was super good, though. I should just make a whole Instagram dedicated to fried food. That should have been my handle from the beginning. Damn.
Well, now you know.
Now I know, yeah. But besides that, again, just working. Not really much more than that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
A lot of, like... Actually, that's not true. I met someone in Miami that... We teamed up and started working on a project together that's like coming to life now.
Oh yeah.
And it's the we're teaming up as a Shot of Truth podcast and their foundation, and we're starting an Indocu speaker series, and we're actually doing call for proposals. So if you're interested, look out for that. Unfortunately, it is kind of just in the Washington area, because we want to be able to travel as a whole. Mostly during spring. So if your universities or colleges are interested, let us know. It's a really cool project, and I'm excited to see what it does and how we can make an impact as we like move around and, you know, get to share again other people's, you know, voices, stories, narratives, whatever they want to share, just again on their terms. Like, I think that's what we always, you know, refer back to. It's like, it should always be on our terms.
And it'll be interesting, and I'm excited because we all have like different stories and narratives and just things to share, you know. So I'm really excited to see how they all like come together.
I know. I'm super excited. It's going to be really fun. I'll post about it on our Instagram page as well. So you can follow that. So let's just dive in to today's topic of border imperialism, which is a giant mouthful. Mm-hmm. But maybe we can start by kind of breaking down imperialism. And one of the ways that, you know, I found that imperialism is best described is essentially like using, like exerting force into taking over other territories. And, you know, this has been something that has happened for thousands of years, but it wasn't necessarily like recognized until like the 16th century. And that's when it was like the term imperialism was coined. And it wasn't until the 19th century that it became like the age of imperialism, in which kind of highlighted all these European nations essentially colonizing other countries, specifically like Africa and the Americas, and, you know, them going into those spaces again, wiping out and displacing millions of people, but also thinking that they did it to benefit everyone because they saw themselves as superior to people of color. And so when people say that, you know, this conversation isn't about race, like if you look back to how, you know, people were displaced and forced, and this whole like idea of superiority and this idea of like, you know, who's better than who and who belongs and who doesn't, even though the people that do belong there were, you know, essentially wiped out or displaced, like. So that in a mouthful is how I would describe imperialism. Is there anything that you want to add to that? Because, you know, it's not just like how borders essentially are like economic and political like policies throughout the country. It's also like, you know, resource based and. I don't know how to finish that sentence.
So resource, and I think resource and like labor based too, right? So they went in with the intention of one, like stealing all the materials and everything that they could find from these lands, as well as looking for cheap labor to bring these new materials and everything back to their own like mainland, I guess. So
when I kind of started learning about border imperialism was really when I saw Harsha Walia at Western Washington University. She is an activist in Canada who was a part of the No One Is Illegal campaign. And, you know, she's like internationally known. She has done amazing work with, you know, like ending detention, ending deportations. And I've been lucky to meet her on several occasions, and I bought her book because I was like, I can't keep like introducing this person and not knowing what they, you know, what they've done. And so as I was reading this book, I started having all these questions of like, how did I not like one see this, or like I didn't have the words to like, you know, explain it. And also like it paints such good pictures of how this affects people. And also like within it there's a lot of like poetry and art that I think highlights and gives even more power to what Harsha is trying to like share with the world.
And it's also like a very easy read. There is a lot of information and everything on there, but like you said, the art, the poems and everything also make you like really put kind of like a face to say it, you know. And really, like, put yourself in that place of feeling what the folks who are undocumented or refugees or migrant, you know, have to go through with their life experience as living as such.
So one of the really, like, essentially what Harsha did was paint this picture of border imperialism in four different parts. And I think we're just going to list them off and then go back and talk about them in detail, because we have like clear examples on, you know, what all those encompass. And I think, again, you know, it's not something that you like read once and understand. It's something that you have to like read over and over again and start connecting it to your experiences, that of others. Like it just, let's just go with it. All right. So the first one is the free flow of capitalism leading to mass displacement.
The second one is the criminalization of migrants.
The third one is entrenchment of a racialized national and imperial identity.
Number four, the legal denial of permanent residency to a growing number of migrants to ensure a level of exploitation.
So let's go back and kind of give a little bit more examples about what some of these things mean. So the first one, the free flow of capitalism being like, you know, creating mass displacement.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect example, and we use this example
a lot
is, you know, the NAFTA. Because at the same time that, you know, NAFTA was, you know, being pushed, so was tightening our borders. Mm-hmm. So what, like, so much more money was being invested into that at the same time, because politicians knew that this is what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. This was going to be the result of, you know, no longer subsidizing corn in the U.S. So it's a lot cheaper in the U.S. than it is in Mexico, which again, you know, again, created this like huge mass displacement of people. Mm-hmm. Because they were forced to migrate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they wouldn't have migrated if they didn't have to. Like, yeah. The reason they left is because they could no longer survive in their native homes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With that also came the privatization of land, right? And so in Mexico, a lot of the farmers there, they were forced kind of to give up their lands. And then that's what also caused a lot of the migrant people to come over and in search of jobs and all that.
There's this, there's something I'm going to read off of the book that I like has really resonated with me. And I've probably read this sentence various times, because I think it just explains things really well.
Mm-hmm.
So what it says, in other words, global capitalism creates migrant workers. In a sense, this must be seen as coerced or forced migration, since global capitalism exerts a structural violence over whole populations and makes it impossible for them to survive in their homelands.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's exactly what NAFTA did.
Yep. And various other policies mm-hmm. that have happened around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, a good example and a pretty simple one for people to understand on the first one. But the second one, I think we are seeing, you know, we've seen for decades, but I think is now been obviously talked about a lot more. And it was the criminalization of migrants and immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And constantly using this like criminalization narrative to kind of scapegoat and like blame everything on a group of mm-hmm. of people that came here out of necessity and survival.
Yes. And we saw that all also throughout the 2016 elections, in the way that Trump, you know, blamed Mexicans or the Salvadorians, just any like kind of like person of color.
And with like the criminalization of migrants, like we also have to think about, you know, how politicians use these narratives to kind of push their agendas, and they use them and people listen. Like, you know, Trump's whole campaign was based off this wall, in which got a lot of people more interested in essentially creating this stronger division of who belongs and who doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So again, harmful generalizations. One of the other things of criminalizing immigrants is border militarization. So we're investing tons of money into, you know, protecting our borders.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point where some, like, even civilians think that they are capable and qualified to go and protect their borders with their own guns, mm-hmm. without any training whatsoever. They just feel that necessity. It's nationalism, you know. Yes. They feel this mm-hmm. like, I need to protect my country because this is my country.
Mm-hmm. Something that I really liked from Harsha Walia in one of her talks that I listened to was she states, whiteness is seen as natural to Turtle Island. It displaces indigenous people and naturalizes colonization as a benevolent act rather than the violence that it brought forth. And so I think of that, like every time I think of these people, right, and their nationalism of I gotta protect what's mine, because the erasure of like all the indigenous people really does bring that like whiteness is natural, right? I think everybody who is not originally from this continent has forgotten that they're not from here.
And they also kind of roll their eyes when you bring that up. They're mm-hmm. like, oh, you're one of those people, or like, you know, it's because they had no connection to
mm-hmm.
that like initial move, they feel like they're not at blame for it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think even recognizing that you benefit from all this, yeah, like, is a start. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people just aren't even willing to do that.
Yeah. They're just like, yeah.
And along with, like, border militarization, like, us investing money to militarize our borders means that we are okay with people being killed at our borders. Mm-hmm. And it is happening. There's been various instances of a border patrol fucking shooting someone and, yeah, and or raping women, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're investing money into this. And, you know, the real topic we're going to be talking about is, you're going to see a little bit of this as well. Another thing with, you know, criminalizing migrants, it creates a system of profiting off of their bodies. So not only are they going to be exploited on, you know, in the workforce, in the labor force, they're going to be exploited when they're detained. So again, this criminalization is profiting off these people's bodies simply by detaining them because they, A, again, don't belong, and two, are seen as these criminals, these people that are being dehumanized, and just, you know, that allows for people to be desensitized to mm-hmm. what is actually happening to these people. Mm-hmm. So I think those are kind of, you know, prime examples of what criminalizing migrants and immigrants is like in the United States. And that's not even, long story short, last night we were at a bar, and we were hanging out with 5 or 6 of our friends, like, just minding our own business. Mm-hmm. And do you want to tell them what happened? I feel like I'm talking a lot.
Yeah, so last night we were at a bar and we were just all, like, you know, enjoying our time. So I had come up and I, like, talked to one of my past roommates and I was like, yeah, let's go get a drink. So we do that and she comes with 2 friends and I think it was like, what, like 6 of us probably. And some random dude just comes, like, to our table, yells,
MAGA.
And at first I was like, I didn't, you know, like, make anything of it. I was like, what did he yell? Kind of like, I didn't understand. But then it kind of just, like, slowly starts clicking, right? And then I think you get up.
And everybody's like, no, come back.
So, I think he's a fighter. I mean.
You're not supposed to tell people that.
Okay, fine. Well, they all know.
Wow. Okay, anyway. So the part of the point of the story was essentially that, you know, there's other layers of mm-hmm. immigrants and migrants being criminalized, and that is stemming from racism mm-hmm. and, you know, the things that we just experience on an everyday basis. And, like, that was just, like, uncalled for. Like, why?
We were minding our own business. Like, we were just trying to have a good time, catch up, you know?
And for anyone to argue that that wasn't racist, like, it was because it was a table of brown people sitting there, mm-hmm. like, doing our own thing.
Yeah.
So again, layers and layers to all of this. The third one is the entrenchment of a racialized national and imperial identity. And this one's really important because this one kind of stems, like, with white supremacy in the sense that, you know, people start defining what it means to be a citizen. What does citizenship mean? Mm-hmm. And they identify it with being white. And they identify it with, you know,
patriotism.
Yeah, exactly. And nationalism and, like, painting this picture of who belongs and who doesn't and for why. And people are really, really tied to this. People mm-hmm. very much so, you know, have this picture of who belongs and who doesn't. Even if you don't believe it, you know, it's, like, painted in everything we see through the media, through TV shows, like, through music, you name it.
Yes. And I think that word, like, example of a citizen or citizen and all that is also, like, thrown out, like, everywhere. And so then that's how you slowly, or people have slowly started to, you know, paint that picture of, like, what
normalizing what citizen means mm-hmm. and making it seem like it's this, like, superior, innocent, law-abiding mm-hmm. situation when that's not the case.
Yeah.
So when we paint this picture of who belongs and who doesn't, then we're completely excluding large populations of the United States, which already do not have equal access to education, healthcare, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever I, you know, whenever I talk to people about this one in specific, I always have to like ask them like, so what do you, like, how would you define a citizen? What does that look like? Paint that paint that visual picture for me, because mm-hmm. it's always the same thing. And it always has this, it again comes with this like positive connotation of we're law abiding.
Mm-hmm. Hardworking, you know, being able to contribute.
So the fourth one again was the legal denial of permanent residency to a growing number of migrants to ensure that, you know, a level of exploitation. And that one's pretty self-explanatory, you know, like there's always been people that were brought into the United States to essentially do the cheaper jobs,
mm-hmm.
like the H-2A program, the Residential program, like you name it. Like, you know, there's always been policies that bring migrants in to allow white people to enter into another sector of the economy. Mm-hmm. I've said this various times. And what essentially that allows is for, you know, white folks to get higher paying jobs, better benefits, access to, you know, more things, mm-hmm. And lets these people stay at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And if these people remain, you know, exploitable, and again, they're being exploited in the workforce, and then when they're held in detention, and it's this like, this large force that for the most part we haven't been able to do like control.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's like as we progress in generations, we've been learning to kind of
identify it and like figure out how it works and learn kind of like to tackle it, because I think a lot of like a lot of us, I don't know, like especially like for me, I didn't know how to like the terms or, you know, how to name these things until probably exactly. college. And so we're not aware, or maybe we know like the feelings and we can recognize it, but we don't know how to put it into words.
And sometimes neither do our parents, but they know mm-hmm. it, you know, they mm-hmm. know these things. They yeah. experience them every mm-hmm. day.
They know what, you know, exploitation looks like. They know like what that is. But in terms of like fighting against it or how to like bring it up in like a conversation, I feel like before it was like, how do I explain what is going on?
Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to give a quick example of kind of like, I was talking to my mom earlier today on the phone, and she was telling me that she's no longer working at one of the McDonald's that she had been working at because the manager had been really rude to her and was trying to make her do things that my mom cannot do because she's older. She's about to be 60 here soon and still working two full-time jobs. And like, you know, when she told me that, like, I felt so guilty because I was like, I'm supposed to be there for my mom. Like, I asked her, I'm like, do you want me to do anything? Do you want me to talk to, like, mm-hmm. what do you want from me?
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, honestly, like, I'm just done going there. Like, I'm just not going to show up anymore.
Yeah.
So I'm glad, you know, she made that decision for herself. And it's not often that people get to make that decision of, like, I'm not being treated well, so I'm going to leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where a lot of people, for necessity, right? Like, you have to stay. Because that's your income, that's how you feed your family, that's how you're gonna get by. And so they don't have that choice, which is really unfortunate. But I'm really glad that there's like organizations now, like especially like C2C, right, with all the farm workers and like the H2A program, how they were able to like organize them and be like, okay, just because we're here temporary does not mean you can exploit us or mistreat us and treat us and like an inhumane way, right?
Mm-hmm. So after covering some of these concepts and things that we've learned from Harsha Walia's book, you know, there's a real topic that we're here to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen it all over the news, but unfortunately, like, not so much recently, for the reason that, you know, elections and all, but it's the migrant caravan. There's, you know, again, it goes back to like people being displaced and having to be forced mm-hmm. to move out of their native homes.
Yes.
And, you know, I think we're going to cover first like a timeline of it and kind of then discuss like why people are leaving.
Mm-hmm.
and kind of just tie it back to all the things we just talked about with border imperialism. So take it away, Olga.
So here's the look of the caravan and actions by U.S. leaders since the group's journey began in October. October 13th, the migrant caravan forms in the Honduran city of San Pedro Sula and begins to head north. October 15th, the caravan arrives at the Guatemala-Honduran border, facing a blockade by local police for nearly 2 hours, and police eventually allow them to go through as they refuse to turn back. On October 16th, President Trump tweets he's told Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, El Salvador, and Guatemala that no more money or aid would be given if they allowed the caravan to continue. On October 19th, migrants reach the Guatemala-Mexico border and begin to request asylum in Mexico. On October 20th, battling sweltering heat while waiting to cross the border, some migrants begin to cross into Mexico using makeshift rafts to cross the Suchiat River and climbing over fences. October 21st, crowds of migrants continue their journey north through the Mexican border town of Ciudad Hidalgo. Buses took migrants about 23 miles to shelters in Tapachula. On October 24th, another caravan is reportedly forming in El Salvador, bound for the U.S.-Mexico border. The migrants reportedly plan to leave on the 31st of October. October 23rd, Mexicans reach Huichatla, Mexico, about 50 miles from the Mexican-Guatemalan border. The caravan remains an estimated month or more from the U.S. border. On October 26th, the Pentagon approves a request for additional troops, possibly hundreds, at the U.S. southern border to assist Border Patrol. On October 27th, migrants reportedly reject Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto's offer to apply for refugee status and obtain shelter, medical attention, schooling, and jobs in the Mexican states of Chiapas and Oaxaca. October 31st, Department of Defense says 7,000 troops will be deployed to the U.S. southern border based in Texas, Arizona, and California. October 31st, Department of Defense says 7,000 troops will be deployed to the U.S. southern border based in Texas, Arizona, and California. That same day, President Trump says that he will deploy a total number as high as 15,000 troops to the border before the caravan arrives.
So, you know, we should question at first, you know, why people are leaving. Like, why are these people coming here? And I think that, you know, we're just going to share a couple clips that we think are relevant to sharing. Play clip here.
Mario, ahorita quiero morir.
¿Cuántos años tenés?
12.
Mario, ¿y tú con quién viajas?
Solo.
¿Solo? ¿Y por qué?
Por la Mara, por mucho la mismo y por todo. Porque ni pisto, si ni siquiera trabaja, nada de espiritualidad. Y con el único pisto que te dan es lo roban.
¿Y cómo te enteraste de la caravana?
Con las noticias también.
Ah, bueno. ¿Y tu mamá sabe que venís?
Sí.
¿Y qué te dijo tu mamá?
Hola, que si era el arte tan de paz. En nombre de Dios.
¿Hasta dónde quieres llegar, Mario? ¿Y qué quieres hacer en Estados Unidos?
Estudiar y trabajar
también. ¿Qué te gustaría estudiar?
Es lo que sea, contar que estás
listo. So in this one you can hear a 12-year-old boy talking about how he joined the caravan by himself, you know, in pursuit of something better for his life. You know, going into education, getting a job, being able to send money to his mother. Mm-hmm. You know, this little boy made that decision at 12 years old to travel thousands of miles to the United States for mm-hmm. a better life. That is not an easy thing for someone to do.
Yeah.
And
I think on his parents or his mother either.
Like, exactly.
You're letting your child go into like the unknown, basically, because she, I'm assuming she doesn't know how the journey will be. And
yeah, exactly. And what gets me about this specific clip is that in the video, he's smiling.
Mm-hmm.
He's a happy 12-year-old boy, you know, knowing that there's something better to come. And that was like, that like really like hit home for me, was seeing that he was still smiling through all the trauma and, you know, the cold weather, the hot weather, not having food, like the walking for endless hours on
mm-hmm.
seeing like people probably like collapse from yeah. like, whether that's, you know, heat exhaustion or not having food or water, like that, crossing borders with police being ready to like shoot at them, like, you know, this is nothing that a 12-year-old boy or anyone should have to experience.
Mm-hmm.
And could you please tell us what inspired you to make this journey?
She says she really has struggled in her country. She doesn't make enough money to support her 5 children. She only makes about approximately $40 per month, so obviously that's not enough to make for her cost of living, for her children, and she's just looking for a better life.
So now that we heard like various things from people traveling across countries to come here, like, you know, you hear that they're coming here for a better life. You hear they're coming because they want something better for themselves, and you know, they were displaced, they were forced to leave. So, you know, so then why are politicians using this narrative of, you know, invasion, like they're coming to invade this country? And, you know, another thing is, like, even though the migrant caravan hasn't arrived to the United States, or, you know, actually, like, I'm sure hundreds of families have every day since it started and before, but like, how is that affecting immigration policies currently in the U.S., especially with elections just happening?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, how are people leveraging different things based on something that's not, that is yet, that's coming, but is not here, you know? Again, it's like they're using it for political gain in one way or another. And, you know, we've heard politicians say really fucked up comments about the caravan, and not just politicians, but also just people.
Mm-hmm.
I saw one that it was this man saying, like, shoot them all, like, shoot the children, like, and I was just like, I couldn't even believe that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to see how a lot of people have lost their, like, it's hard to see how a lot of people have dehumanized, right, everybody that's coming in the caravan, especially the children and like the babies, and where it's really like that, whether like just shoot them all or they're not welcome here. And I think especially we see that now with all the civilians, you know, ready to go to the border and like arm themselves up to defend this country and their land and blah blah blah.
So with, you know, the threats that, you know, the cutting funding and aid to those other countries, other things that, you know, the Trump administration has pushed is thousands and thousands of military troops being sent to the border. I saw a really, like, it wasn't funny, but it was like, makes sense kind of thing, where it was like a meme talking about, like, where were all these military troops when Hurricane Katrina hit, or when this natural disaster hit,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, like they never came out to help the people in that way. But now that we have to protect our borders, and again, what are these troops expected to do? Are they just like gonna stand there and arrest them? No, they're gonna fucking shoot them. They're gonna detain them. They're gonna do whatever they can so these people do not cross over. I don't know to what extent legally or what, but again, we've been militarizing our borders, mm-hmm. which make it like okay, I guess, to kill people at them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and something that has been on the news and that President Trump has stated is that, like, if they throw rocks, shoot them. Like, what is a rock compared to the weapons and to all the military gear, right, that these troops are going to have at hand?
And how do the, like, you know, I can't assume every single one of these troops feels like this is okay. Mm-hmm. So, like, how do they feel and how are they, what can they do? Mm-hmm. They essentially sign their lives away when joining the military. Mm-hmm. And I had an instance with someone that was like, I'm a Marine and I agree that, you know, or I disagree with your points on the migrant caravan. And he didn't really care to hear about my points. He just kind of was like, you're wrong. I'm right. I'm a Marine and I know what I'm talking about. And they're mm-hmm. invading our country. Mm-hmm. And I was like crying because I was just like, who are you?
Yeah.
Like, I just couldn't wrap my head around understanding how someone just like has desensitized themselves so far out that they can't even see the human mm-hmm. and these people.
It's not only them. This is something that is fed to, I think, all the military branches, right? Whether it's Marines, whether it's Navy, Army, I think especially Army, because they're the first ones to go up front. And I don't know if it's correct to mention it or not, but I used to date somebody in the Army, and they would talk to me about the different ways that the military would, like, kind of like brainwash them with, you know, certain ideas and stuff like that. And although, like, I already had a picture of, like, and I could imagine that, it was a lot more like eye-opening to hear it from somebody and to hear like their experiences and everything really that the military does, right, with all these bodies.
So a question that we were also thinking about when we started kind of going over what we wanted to discuss was like, what is the rest of the world thinking? What is the rest of the world saying about this situation? Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is, again, are things that we have seen. I'm sure there's other negative things on top of that. But I think we would like to personally focus on, well, no, scratch that. The Canada one isn't positive. But that is a manipulating tactic that we'll talk about in a second. So the first one, like, you know, something that I've seen constantly about the caravan entering Mexico is a lot of the communities organizing to supply them food and mm-hmm. water and some kind of encampment. So they have shelter for the night. There's been a lot of people that immediately, you know, got together to help these people because mm-hmm. and they do it so, like, empathetically. And you know, something that I read that this lady said is like, we do it with love mm-hmm. because that could be them someday. Mm-hmm. And they recognize that. And I think that, like, I don't know, that was just so powerful to me to think that, you know, there are people that want to help them as they're moving through.
Mm-hmm. I know. I've seen a lot of those too. And it's very heartwarming to see really people connect with one another, right? Because a lot that I've, like, heard is that those could be us, or that could be, you know, like my daughter or son, you know, like somebody connected to me going through that experience one day. With that also, I think we have to say that unfortunately it wasn't like everybody being very welcoming, right? Yeah. Because just as the US is very like nationalist and racist, mm-hmm. Mexico is as well.
Is very, very nationalist. So what's the solution to all of this? What is the solution to, you know, people coming to the U.S., the migrant caravan and docu folks we have here, refugees? Like, what do we see as a solution? And I think that's, you know, when we bring everyone on to ask what their liberation looks like, you know, mm-hmm. everyone gives us, like, very different answers. But I think it encompasses, you know, the same thing. And like, again, from, the Undoing Border Imperialism, I really like the way they wrap it up and they say, you know, essentially we're advocating for full regularization, also known as like legalization or amnesty to all undocu folks, non-status and temporary migrants. Mm-hmm. And this essentially pulls people out of being invisible and recognizes like the steps that we have to do to move forward in making, you know, these people known and give them access to what is healthcare, education, social assistance, labor protection being mm-hmm. huge, and just like housing, legal aid, and other services. And, you know, one of the things that they say that they really, really advocate for and that they look at is, you know, there's not a single person that is more deserving than another person.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever we do is for the good of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
It does not like discriminate against race, class, educational background, faith, gender, various other things, including criminal record. Like there is no, you know, we're advocating for people to be able to live a sustainable life without mm-hmm. the fear of being deported and detained. So, you know, that really wraps up like what a lot of us are thinking is like, how can we move forward and not fear this? And how can we heal through all of this? And how can we gain those things that we do not have access to, which we should, we're humans. It's about human dignity, right?
Yeah. It's about just like giving up, like meeting our basic needs, right? Because I think in no matter where you're from or what country or anything, I think everybody should be able to access education, health, and resources to be able to live like a basic, you know, healthy life. Because a lot of the problems or a lot of the root to the problems is either the lack of X, Y, or Z, right? Whether that's like the lack of education, and then that leads some people to like one direction, or the lack of financial stability, and that leads, you know, you to take a different path. And sometimes that path is one that isn't healthy, I guess, to put it that way.
I think something someone would say, you know, to counter what we just said about, you know, giving everyone some sort of amnesty mm-hmm. and access, would be like why they're not contributing, or they're not, you know, here to make the country better, or their whatever mm-hmm. their counter argument is. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the things is that we don't look as like that. It says it in this book, and it's just a general value of mine, is like we don't look at people for what they're worth and mm-hmm. what they bring to the table, and like how they like contribute to our economy, because that's not the purpose of life.
Yeah.
To contribute to one's economy, like, and I think, you know, when we start erasing like these pictures of, you know, these people are beneficial to me in some way mm-hmm. or they have to be worth something to mm-hmm. be here,
yeah,
that's when we again start seeing the human in these people and in us and mm-hmm. in all of us. Yeah. So I think it's again, various layers of things that need to be undone, relearned, challenged, educated. Like what? So many things.
So many.
So is there anything you want to close with, Olga?
I think to add to that, like just something that has been like on my mind also is how legality is also very like racialized, right? Because I'm thinking of like all the like the Russians or the like the white immigrants that come
mm-hmm.
and how very little is talked about them. To throw like anybody else under the bus, you know?
Yeah.
But
yeah, you're right. Like if you walk into a detention center, you're gonna see black and brown people. You're not gonna see white folks because they're mm-hmm. not targeted
mm-hmm.
like we are.
Yeah. So something else that Harsha Walia also states is like, when you think of what's the largest population of undocumented folks up there in Canada, a lot of the people comment back like, oh, you know, like either like Mexicans or Latinx folks, you know, anybody kind of like south from the border. Who else? I think like Asians, but the largest population of undocumented folks up there in Canada are actually white Australians.
So I guess one of the things that has been on my mind along with the migrant caravan is some of the photos that have come out. And mm-hmm. one in particular is like an older gentleman holding a baby really close to them. And you can tell that something traumatic is happening and that they're like mm-hmm. running for their lives mm-hmm. essentially. And that like when you see that photo, it just like, he's staring you in the eye and it just like resonates really hard with you. And these photos we're seeing are just really impactful. And I think a lot of people feel a little hopeless too. Like I know that there's various of my friends, that are having a hard time with, you know, trying to see what they could do about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they are still making their way to the United States. And, like, one of the things that, you know, we're going to say is, like, donate to the nonprofits that work directly near mm-hmm. the border.
Yeah.
Like, specifically in the Rio Grande Valley, where that's the point where most people cross. Like, mm-hmm. donate to those efforts, because there is something you can do. And, you know, I think it's, we did this whole podcast on this because we want to bring light to what is happening, but we also want you to realize what the root of the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
And know that the root of the problem wasn't stemmed by the people that are sacrificing their lives to come here.
Yeah, that it goes way deeper beyond that, and it's way past them and what they can do, right? That this is something caused, like, a global kind of, like, effect that has led them to forced migrate.
Yeah, imagine walking thousands and thousands of miles, not knowing when you would get water again, where your next meal would be, where you can use the bathroom, like, where you'll get medical assistance. Like, this is, like, you know, these people left everything that they had because even the chance of having something better or something else was enough to sacrifice their lives for. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at ashotoftruthpodcast@gmail.com. You can also send us a nice tweet at @ShotOfTruthPodcast or look on Instagram for behind-the-scenes photos at @ShotOfTruthPodcast. You can also find us on Patreon and donate to our podcast at @ShotOfTruthPodcast. You can just assume it's all Shot of Truth Podcast. Podcast, podcast, podcast. A Shot of Truth Podcast, A Shot of Truth Podcast, A Shot of Truth Podcast.
This has been a production.